Miami Memoirs presents real case histories and true stories related to the law practice and experiences of Florida attorney Louis M. Ress. Miami Memoirs uncorks a caseload of true, weird, wonderful, and wild stories from an always eventful 6 decades of life in the law. From multimillion-dollar land deals to the ghostly aftermath of an Everglades plane disaster via a prematurely deep-frozen cat, these tales feature a parade of unforgettable characters, all sharply observed by a storyteller with a very human empathy for ordinary and extraordinary individuals caught up in the law.
Louis has just released a new book, Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Fans of strange cases and wild tales will need no introduction to the author's brilliant and fast-paced storytelling, laced with salty evocations of the human carnival of the era and shot through with compassionate insight. From advising the heir to Colonel Sanders and falling out with Buddy Hackett to nighttime jogging with Vitas Gerulaitis, the stories keep on coming. Larry the charismatic wheeler dealer needs to be rescued from yet another risky deal, and a bridge-playing mobster needs help to find his missing daughter. All this and more, along with sage advice against buying a lottery ticket you might win. Welcome to round two. And now, let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Brez. I'm Jeanette Garcia, your host, and today we're on episode 51, Transition. So how are you doing today, Louis? We made it out of Brooklyn into Miami. What was that like? I'm assuming this is going to cover that a little bit.
I'm here. I made it out of Brooklyn. Well, yes, I did. This transition is what happened to me after I got out of the military and I came down to Florida. Mm-hmm. And I had really, Florida was a rough place. Miami was a nasty place. It was undeveloped and it was mm-hmm. very slow. It was a real southern town. And people can't comprehend. Now it's a vibrant city.
Multicultural.
I think probably the most expensive city in America. Yeah. And it's jumping, culturally exciting, and a lot of activity. In those days, it was a slow, plodding southern town.
Swampland.
Yeah, it wasn't swamps, but it was very slow.
Yeah.
And very lethargic pace. Hmm. Everything was slow. And they, in the summertime, Miami closed in August, and everyone moved up to North Carolina.
Oh.
You could take a gun and shoot it down the main street, Flagler Street, and not worry about hitting anybody.
Wow. So people just left.
And they were all up in Hendersonville, North Carolina.
People come and visit here, which is crazy.
Yeah, so now it's a big season. There was no summer season. Everything was closed in the summer. They mm-hmm. boarded up. And of course, air conditioning wasn't available all over. And it was hot as hell.
Miserable.
Anyhow, this is the story of transition. Mm-hmm. I finally got a job. And George Case was my first and only employer. I never had any other employer. Yeah. And he was about 8 years older than I. And he said that his family originally came from the Bahamas, from Green Turtle Key. And he sort of looked Bahamian, on the short side, permanently tanned, with dark straight hair, and he had a South Florida accent. George was a World War II veteran. He had flown fighter planes in the South Pacific. He was stationed in Adelaide, Australia, and he started out flying the Brewster Buffalo Tiger, and he graduated to the P-40 Warhawk, and then the P-51 Mustang. That was a great, great plane, the P-51. That plane could climb to over 30,000 feet, and it ran at over 400 miles an hour. I mean, that was huge. In those days, 200 and some odd miles an hour was pretty good. Mm-hmm. So I thought that the P-51s were strictly used in Europe, but evidently not. They eventually flew cover for some of our bombing raids over Japan.
And did your boss tell you about his war experience?
No. George didn't talk much about it, except to tell me that he soiled the entire cockpit of his plane on his first mission.
He was terrified, huh?
Yeah, he said he came back from the war with the need to enjoy his life and have fun, which I told you in one of the earlier podcasts we were talking about out of Brooklyn, mm-hmm. World War II. These guys came back with a different attitude.
Of course.
And it shaped a big change in America work ethics. Hmm. And people were not so worried about knocking themselves out for the boss.
Right.
They wanted to have a good time and fun.
Right.
They wanted to drink and fish and hunt.
Have leisure
and
time.
Travel and camp and enjoy the family and barbecue.
Right, yeah.
It's a different world.
I mean, it makes sense. I would feel the same way.
Well, he worked hard, but he knew how to play. Mm. And he had 2 martinis at lunch every day, followed by a nap.
Nice.
He said that that was caused by ongoing malaria symptoms. And I believed him. And then before heading home, he'd have a cocktail at the office and shake up a cocktail.
Uh-huh.
So there was a lot of drinking, and nobody talked about alcoholism.
Hmm.
In the movies, they always had a cigarette and a drink in their hand.
Everybody did it. It was normal.
Everyone was drinking like crazy. And to this day, the wealthy people in general, that's a big generalization, but the wealthy people drink like fish.
Hmm.
They drink.
Yeah.
And it's a drug, and people enjoy it, and it's relaxing, and they drink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like this was common among war veterans.
How did your
first real job go?
Well, Bill Webb, that's his real name, was a successful builder. And the Webb building still stands about 5 minutes from where we're sitting today on the railroad tracks at 125th Street, just at the tracks west of Biscayne Boulevard.
Oh, okay.
And it didn't have an elevator. It was 2 stories. You had to walk up, you know, so you could put up a sign, Honest Lawyer, 1 flight up. That's where it was. And across the hall, we were 1 flight up, walk up. And across the hall was Bill Webb's business office. And Bill Webb was George's biggest client, my partner's biggest client, my boss. And Bill Webb, in association with a Canadian named Max Golhar, was building warehouses and showrooms and developing a community known as Sunshine State Industrial Park, which today is there. It's a big industrial development just off I-95 at the Cloverleaf.
Okay.
And George handled, my partner, my boss handled all of the closings and contracts involving the park.
And was Webb a good businessman?
Oh, was he a good businessman? Yes, sir. After Bill would complete and sell a warehouse, you know, and he'd do these warehouses for businesses with offices built into the warehouse, then he would paint both the inside and the outside as a gift to the new owner.
Oh, that's a nice add-on, yeah.
And that was very good publicity because they would always recommend him and to other businessmen, and he would wind up getting more business. So George spent a great deal of time drinking with Bill Webb and his Bill Webb's 6-foot-tall redhead girlfriend and her friends from Chicago. And then Bill Webb left his wife and married the 6-foot-tall redhead.
Oh, boy. And what were you doing as far as legal work for Bill Webb?
Well, actually, nothing at the beginning.
Okay.
Initially, my boss, George Cates, put me to work examining real estate titles and issuing written opinions for the local bank's mortgage department. So if you were a history buff, it was good work because the property with its voluminous paper abstract record could be traced back to the original grant from Spain through sales of large tracts and working its way down to development plans for acreage, which were called plats, and into specific blocks and lots. And after a while, as with so much of specialized law practice or even specialized medicine, it becomes repetitive and tedious.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew the history of all these properties going all the way back to the Spanish grants.
Oh, wow.
And I was being paid $50 per exam, and I had to write a written opinion of title, which was a form. We just filled in the forms.
Uh-huh.
And it was a real come down from negotiating, drafting documents for hundreds of millions of dollars, $250 million military contract.
Yeah.
I was doing $50 opinion of titles.
Right. Less pressure.
I kept saying, hang in there, hang in there. Things will get better. Better things are going to happen.
Right. And so what about the Sunshine State Industrial Park?
Well, finally, George Case assigned me some work involving the Sunshine State Industrial Park. Evidently, Bill Webb never met with me. He dealt with George. But George came to my desk, which was still the card table that he started out with and assigned to me. And he gave me the project of writing to each of Webb Construction Company and Sunshine State Industrial Park's creditors, advising them that unless they signed the enclosed form and settled their accounts for 50 cents on the dollar, they would be extinguished in a bankruptcy.
Oh, were Webb and the park bankrupt?
No, not at all. In fact, I had lunch with Vince Coulson, their internal accountant, about two times a week. And he assured me that Webb and the park were doing great. There was no financial stress. This was Mr. Webb's idea to knock down his creditors and make more money.
Ah, okay. And did you do it?
Well, it didn't take a genius to make it clear that George Case and I would be parties to a fraud.
Yeah.
A criminal violation of the federal bankruptcy law, and we could get disbarred or even been charged with a crime and go to jail for this kind of a stunt.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Webb was insisting on it. Evidently, Bill Webb had another attorney drinking friend by the name of Tom Praxley, and I changed that name,
yeah,
who was primarily a bankruptcy attorney. And he came up with this unethical decision or suggestion. Praxley was angling to get the Webb construction account from us to steal it. And George Cates stood with me in refusing to do what we knew was wrong. Instead of taking our legal advice, Webb fired his friend and attorney, George Case, and hired Praxley. I was the new young employee, and I felt that I had caused the loss of our biggest client. You know, you don't want to be the one that discovers something, and you have to, a bell ringer.
Yeah.
You pay the price. The messenger gets shot.
Yeah. Boy, oh boy, there goes your job, right?
I thought I was finished.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to get a job without a recommendation. Mm-hmm. You had to show it was a blank spot in my record.
Yeah.
Well, it was a week later to the day, and talk about luck, when Max Goldhaar, the Canadian partner, called up my boss, George Case. And Max said, "I heard that you and your young associate refused to engage in highly questionable tactics that could have implicated me. Congratulations, you are my kind of guys. I have the controlling stock in the park, and you are rehired. Also, I want you to know that I appreciate what you did, and I want you to represent all of my other interests in Florida."
Wow, good for you. You saved again, and I mean, you did the right thing, and that was admirable.
Josh, look, I'm looking to see if I'm Asian because I believe in luck. What a relief. I don't think that Bill Webb ever understood what Tom Praxley was up to. And he just believed Praxley. And when he heard things that he wanted to hear, and that's what businessmen do. Mm-hmm. When you tell them what they want to hear, whether you're working for Putin or anybody else, you got to tell them, if you're the advisor, you tell them what they want to hear. You're working for Donald Trump, you tell him what he wants to hear. Not what you think, mm-hmm. not anything that's against what he wants to do. Or you're fired, you're ruined, he'll destroy you.
They'll just pick up another one agree.
So they're looking for advisors that tell them what they want to hear.
Yeah.
Of course, Praxley thought it was fine to defraud your creditors to save money. And we had, by refusing to participate, angered Bill Webb.
Hmm.
And Praxley, that damned conniver, he always smiled at my partner George when their paths crossed, but he stole the client. And Bill Webb died not too long after the fake bankruptcy incident. And then Tom Praxley followed shortly thereafter.
Oh, wow.
They all died. And Vincent Coulson, remember the accountant that I was talking about?
Right.
He ran off with Bill Webb's secretary and a lot of Bill Webb's cash.
Oh, my.
And they left a note stating that they were off to find their island in the sky. You're not joking.
Oh, my.
That's their island in the sky. The police found them in a motel down in Key Largo.
Oh, wow. That's another great story in the books. And what happened next?
Well, what happened next? I started to produce clients. And George Case made me gave me the opportunity of buying my own desk. He
would buy it for
me. He took back his card table, and I had to buy my own desk. Of course, I met people at the tennis court, and I got to get in a casualty account, and I started doing their workers' comp and making big fees and friendly suits. And so I was bringing in cash into the firm.
You're bringing the big bucks.
He didn't have to pay me anymore for the work I was doing for him. And I was taking home a bundle.
Yeah.
And that was, the transition was completed.
Yeah, that's very symbolic. From a card table to a desk.
Right. So there's a lot to learn from this very short story.
Quite a bit.
First of all, you're going to get, when you work, into a dilemma. Most people do.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do when you know something is wrong and you're called upon to do it?
Hmm.
It's a dilemma. It's not easy. So you have to decide. First thing you want to do is protect yourself. So instead of thinking about
the other party,
employer and your fellow workers you better think about yourself and your family.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it involves some selfishness. But what do you do when you know something's wrong? And, well, start off for an example. Michael Pence.
Hmm.
Michael Pence was Vice President of the United States, and he was called upon to send back the presidential votes from two or three states when they came up for counting under the Constitution. You know, Congress meets, mm-hmm. and the Vice President certifies the vote, mm-hmm. and then they establish the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's the Electoral College vote.
Right.
Well, the former president called upon him, Michael Pence, to reject the slates and the votes from two or three states, I think Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Oh, gee, how convenient.
Which would have changed the election.
Yep.
And I think Minnesota, Wisconsin. Anyhow, the bottom line is Michael Pence consulted with some people who I don't think are the most brilliant, but he consulted anyhow, and they told him that this is a ceremonial activity and not a discretionary activity.
What?
And, you know, certifying the vote was ceremonial, was mechanical, and he didn't have discretion to reject it.
Right.
He didn't. And so he certified the vote, and Biden was then certified as president, and Trump was told that he lost the election. So he never forgave, and I don't think he'll ever forgive Michael Pence for making that decision. Michael Pence had a dilemma. And if he had decided the other way, it might have proven the end of democracy in the United States. It was a big decision. Okay, so what else do we have? Well, military crimes. Okay.
That's a tough one.
Recently, they had a Russian soldier in Ukraine was charged with shooting two civilians, two Ukrainian civilians, and they were on a bicycle and evidently on the cell phone. And he was said, I was following orders. The officers ordered me to shoot. They said that these people were disclosing our whereabouts, you know, telling where we were on the cell phone. Mm. And we had to stop them. And if I didn't, they my officers would shoot me. I didn't have a choice. Okay?
Wow.
He got life imprisonment.
Wow.
He was found guilty in the court-martial. Of course, court-martials or military trials are not exactly the most liberal.
Yeah.
And not too many people get off.
Right, yeah.
He pleaded guilty because he didn't want to get executed. Then you have prison guards and military crimes. Well, remember the crime where they shot, burned down the village, My Lai, in the Korean...
No, I don't. No.
It wasn't Korea. It was Vietnam.
Hmm.
And they burned down a village and shot everybody.
Oh, my.
And the guy was that did it was convicted of a crime. He was a lieutenant. And he went to jail, and then he was pardoned by the president.
Ugh.
I think it was Nixon who pardoned him.
Oh, my.
Anyhow, commanders are responsible for their troops' misconduct. Mm. So if you're the commander and they rape and loot and so on, you get held up as for war crimes after the war.
Oh, wow.
So you got to be careful to try to stop those things. You got to have a record, a paper trail, saying that you punished the people, you caught them, and you punished the ones who misbehaved.
Right.
Then there are if a lot of hazing incidents in the military, and I talked about those in the past,
mm-hmm.
Particularly against women.
Yep.
But anyone that joins an elite organization, like the Navy SEALs, they have a hell week. That's not nice.
No.
And it doesn't teach you anything. And it's just this foolish thing.
It's a backwards way of doing it.
If you report an infraction, you're ostracized. So you pay the price for reporting it. And so you can't change. Women were sexually assaulted, a lot of them in the military, and they weren't getting any satisfaction. They were told they were troublemakers and that they didn't resist enough.
Wow.
And because schools say that, well, you didn't sufficiently resist a rape.
Wow.
And nobody's going to believe you.
That's terrible.
And the two guys that raped you say you were just lying there and being helpful. So
that's awful.
Sometimes you're constrained to keep things quiet, and then they have mediation and conciliation. These things are often a way of covering it up, the problems, particularly at schools.
Yeah,
and it's still going on nowadays, very badly.
It's definitely a culture of don't report it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Don't.
Because what
don't
does
be
that say?
Snitch.
What does that
don't
say
complain.
To other women that go through it? You
it's
know,
the Me Too.
It's
movement,
not supportive at
you know,
all.
And then you get people in the Me Too movement who use it to lie.
Unfortunately,
I was once accused of doing something which I didn't do, and the woman said I did it because she was a black lady. I never even saw her. She was in the room where I was talking, and I never addressed her.
Mm.
And she said I threatened her and whatever. The wound up that they realized that she was making all of this up.
Hmm.
And the people do that.
Yeah, unfortunately.
She was trying to gain the presidency of this organization, and she was using it as a tool.
Hmm.
So those things happen, and you feel terrible when you're accused of something you didn't do.
Right.
And then... people are a tendency to shoot the messenger. So that's a problem. And again, luck. Well, there were a lot of things we could have done. Luck is a big factor in getting around this stuff. Sometimes you can keep prodding and they'll listen to you. But reporting a wrong is a very difficult thing.
Yeah.
And you pay the price.
Yeah, it's also...
Well, our society is twisted.
Yeah, it's also who you end up reporting to. What is that person like? Yeah,
I like polygraphs. People don't like polygraphs. I do. And I think they work. And I think if you do the eye polygraph along with the blood pressure and so forth, you get a very good result. And they should say to anyone that's got a problem, if you take the polygraph, we'll pursue it. Take the polygraph. It's no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You should pass it.
Right.
If you're telling the truth, you just relax and answer the questions. And that would screen out a lot of problems.
That's true.
So,
yeah.
And a lot of people who were creating a complaint wouldn't do it if they knew they had to go through a polygraph.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking about big mistakes and what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I started to think of... the Ford Pinto case. Do you remember that at all?
Nope.
Oh, boy. An interesting story. A story within a story. Ford Motor Company. Oh, that wonderful Ford. You know, the Ford Foundation.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, the Ford Pinto was a small Ford automobile, like a mini series, a smaller car.
Hmm.
And the gas tank was put in the back right near the muffler.
Oh.
Strapped to the muffler.
Oh, boy.
Right next to the muffler. And there was a strap holding it down. And the car was very likely to burst into flames.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, the engineers at Ford were pretty smart, and they knew about the defects. Before the car went into production, was placed on the market, they did a cost study, and they found that it was cheaper to pay for burn deaths and injuries than modify the tank. So
that's terrible.
They had a case, the Grimshaw case, where Grimshaw was given $125 million punitive damages. And, of course, the judge reduced it down to $3.5 million. And he was burned when the rear end of the Ford Pinto blew up, went on fire. And the Ford reconsidered. Well, of course, that got the government involved. This was 1971 to 76. And it involved the Mercury from 1975 to 1976, the Mercury Bobcat and the Ford Pinto.
Wow.
So the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, they started looking at it. Well, you know, like the government interfering in your life and what, everyone hates the government. Well, here they are. Ford Motor Company would still be producing cars with the gas tank
faulty gas
to the muffler or whatever.
If it wasn't for regulations.
The government's got to come in. And people ignore the importance of government and the saving factor saves your life. And
yeah.
Makes things drugs and prescriptions safer and food. And so now Ford was compelled to do away with the Pinto, which they did.
Yes.
Now, wow. That's an interesting story. So we talk about what happened with me with Webb Construction. Well, Max Goldhaus saved the day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, that doesn't happen. That's Joss. Max Goldhaus was Canadian, a Jewish guy, a CPA, and a very, very wonderful human being, and who had integrity. And he was thrilled to make sure that he didn't want to be involved in anything illegal. So what could I have done? Well, you know, you make your own luck to some degree. I could have called Max Goldhaus myself, or my partner could have, my boss,
mm-hmm.
and said, Max, we know you have an interest in this and your life is being affected. And there's a guy by the name of Paxley who's trying to get Bill Webb to do something which we think is illegal
yeah.
and it's going to involve you. And we're concerned. Do it orally, quietly.
Uh-huh.
When are you coming down from Canada, from Toronto? Let's have a drink. Come down. Let's talk. We want to show you what he wants us to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way, to go behind Webb. The second way is to go to Webb and say, look, this is what Paxley is telling you to do. You're going to get in trouble. We're worried about you. We're here to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
You could be charged with a crime. You mm-hmm. could be charged with doing this. If you really insist, you can do it on your own. Tell Paxley to give you the form. And have your employees send out the thing. You don't need us, but you're making a mistake, and we're mm-hmm. here to advise
just letting
you
know.
Protect you.
Yep.
We're your attorneys, and we're loyal to you. Paxley's trying to steal the account from us, and this is what he's willing to do. He's willing to jeopardize you and your company in order to knock us out.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way of doing it. That's what we could. Those were some of the ways we could have solved it. But fortunately, Max Cole got involved directly. So there was another time, you'll hear of it in the city of Parkland, which is coming up for a podcast.
Hmm.
The city of Parkland, I represented the trustee for compensation. He was getting 3% of the sales price for being the trustee. There were two trustees,
mm-hmm.
two doctors, and Ed Trumpet was one of them. Ed Trumpet. And that's a change of his name. And he told me, I got a call from a foreign company, from Westinghouse, saying we want to buy this property. We're talking about 2,000 acres up in Parkland. We're interested in buying the property mm-hmm. and acquiring the property. And we'd like to meet with you. I said, well, why don't you meet with Dr. Trumpet? We know Dr. Trumpet. He says, anyone who's willing to pay something for property is going to make a profit, and therefore they never pay enough.
Oh, okay.
They're out to make a profit. They think it's worth more. They're never going to pay you the real value.
Right.
So you can't deal with somebody like that. Hmm. And he said, you come up. We want to meet with you.
Hmm.
So I went up and met with them, and they said, we want you to convey to Dr. Trumpet that we're interested, or we want you to convey to your group that we're interested in buying this property. We're going to make you an offer. So I did. And Dr. Trumpet says, stop all negotiations. It's not good for my personal tax situation. I don't want to sell the property. I want to keep it. And stop.
Uh-huh.
I said, there are 50 people in this trust. You are a trustee for compensation. You have a fiduciary relationship. You've heard of Fisher Investments on TV, the fiduciary relationship.
Yes.
We do better when our clients do better.
Yeah.
Well, he had a fiduciary relationship. It's one of the most sacred relationships you can have, where you have to protect the client first, the person mm-hmm. you're the trustee for, and you must pass on offers. And not only that, you have to do your best to sell the property, even if you don't want to do it personally.
Huh.
Well, he got so angry, he fired me on the spot. He said, you do as I tell you. I said, I love you, but I can't. I'm in a bad spot here. He says, you're fired. You're not in any bad spot. Go, get out of here. Well, the other trustee heard about it, and he called me up. He said, I'm 50% trustee. He didn't consult me. You're hired.
I'll take you. Come on,
yeah,
Lewis.
He says, we're going to sell it. And it's a whole story.
Oh, boy.
But I was saved by the partner the second time.
Yeah.
A lot of things clients ask you to do in the law practice that can get you into trouble.
Questionable, yes.
One of them is to notarize a document when they're not there. They bring in a document and say, my wife signed this at home. Will you please put the note? She doesn't want to come in.
Uh-uh.
Okay?
You have to see the person signing it.
You have to be very tactful and tell them what a danger they're in, that you have to protect them.
Mm.
That if you do this, they could get in trouble for soliciting a crime. And she's got to come in, or we'll go over. We'll send someone over to her with a notary stamp, and we'll right. take it at your home. Witness something or certify something that someone's witnessed that you haven't been present. You can't do that, and you're going to wind up breaking the law.
Yeah.
And of course, criminals want to use or break the law all the time. So you got to be careful if you're representing somebody who is a criminal.
Yeah.
Politicians violate the law all the time.
Oh yeah.
They. You know, like I hate to say this, but there's a justice on the Supreme Court, an associate justice, who I think is wrong. He has a conflict of interest. His wife is into politics, and she's a very strong right-wing supporter of the extreme groups. What's that crazy group that?
There's so many of them. I lose track.
Yeah, fringe of the Republican Party. They believe in all kinds of crazy theories, the replacement theory, and that kind of stuff.
Oh my!
That. Whites are being replaced by blacks and browns and Jews.
Oh, goodness.
So anyhow, he doesn't recuse himself from cases where his wife's violent political beliefs, extreme political beliefs, in which he lives in her home and it's his wife, mm-hmm. and he feels comfortable sitting in cases involving that issue, those issues, and he shouldn't do that.
Nope.
We have money from lobbyists. The coal industry and the pharmacy industry give money to senators and congressmen, and they vote for them.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan said politicians are like babies in diapers. They have an awful, terrible stench sometimes, and they need changing often.
Yeah, so I like that.
We all violate one law or another every day. We don't disclose information. We fail to report. We look at the driving violations. How many times have you gone through an amber light that turns red just before you get to the intersection and you're through the red light?
Yeah.
Jaywalking. How many times have you crossed and not at the end of the street?
Yep, done
crossing it. Against the red light. How many times have you walked across when the light was red?
A couple times.
Yeah. Trash, lawns, God knows, we're always violating the law.
Mm-hmm.
So, luck, and more luck. I tell you a story about about the Korean War, what happens when you're told to do something you don't want to do. There was a general in the Korean War who set up a grandstand in the field opposite a big hill. The hill was maybe 3 miles away. You could see it clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he called a press conference, and he had all the reporters and the TV, and he says, we're going to take Hill 52. He said, I'm going to let you watch us take it.
My unit's going to take it.
Well, the unit commander comes in and says, General, in all due respect, General says, charge, take the hill. He says, General, in all due respect, that hill is heavily fortified. And it's not ready. We can't take it. He says, what do you mean? We bombed the hell out of it. He said, General, they have tunnels going through the hill to the other side. And we didn't bomb the backside.
Right.
And we got to go in there with flamethrowers. And it's going to be heavy loss of men. Heavy and unnecessary. We don't need Hill 52. It's not strategically significant.
Yeah.
He said, I told you to take Hill 52. Now charge.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, what does the commander do? He says, charge, boys. Well, now this is the regimental commander. Well, the captain comes up. He says, Colonel, you're mm-mm. telling me to send my men up there. I got 150 men under my command to send them up there. We're going to get killed. He says, I told you, charge. So now you charge or you get court-martialed and shot. You get a choice.
My gosh.
Being killed by the enemy in combat. Or being
killed by your own country.
By your own firing squad.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do? Well, the first thing you do is you shoot yourself in the leg.
Uh-huh.
And you say, oh, my God, I've shot off my toe. help me. I need help. Get the medics. And you roll on the ground in terrible pain. Oh, I didn't realize that. I grabbed my gun, and it went off.
Discharged, yeah.
Okay. So you lose the toe. and you get the Purple Heart. And however,
oh my gosh,
you've lost your toe and you're bleeding and you could die.
Yeah.
So what is the best way? The best way is you roll on the floor and you start screaming and ripping off your clothes.
Just insanity?
You have a fit. Yeah. You throw a temper tantrum and a fit, screaming and salivating and moaning. And they say, oh, this guy's nuts.
Yeah.
They call a stretcher and they take you away to the psychiatric department.
Oh, good.
Where you continue to scream and yell. And they give you some morphine to calm you down.
Oh, my.
And they give you a Section 8. They throw you out of the service because you're psychiatrically disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
But you're alive and suddenly you make a wonderful recovery.
It was a mental breakdown.
So... those are some of the stories about what happens when you're called upon to do something that you don't want to do.
You got some options.
Yeah, you do.
Thank you, Lewis. That was quite the tale. And I can't wait until our next one.
Well, thank you.
See you next time.
It was a pleasure.
And, always.
Always concern yourself about being asked to do something you don't want to do.
Yeah. Make sure you make the right call, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Thank you for listening. We are excited to announce that Lewis now has his own blog. Visit lewisres.com to get insightful commentary to the Miami Memoirs podcasts, along with an analysis of current events, as only Lewis can provide.